This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. President Trump declared a national emergency to free up more money to build a wall along the southern U.S. border. The president made the announcement last week after agreeing to a funding deal to avoid another government shutdown. So how's the declaration of emergency playing with lawmakers in Central Florida? For more, we turn to political analysts Frank Torres and Jason Henry. Frank Torres is a Republican political analyst. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we're also joined by Jason Henry. He's a Democratic political analyst. Thank you, Jason.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with the speech from last week. We had the weekend to process the president's announcement of a national emergency. He'd signaled he was going to declare the national emergency, use it in some way to try and pay for the wall that he wants to build. Frank Torres, first impressions from that speech?
Well, it seemed like he spoke off prompter this time. This was the Donald Trump that we're used to, not so much the State of the Union prepared remarks Donald Trump that we heard on various nights throughout his administration. He told it the way it is, and including laying out the process it's likely going to go to. He laid out the challenges that are standing in the way of his decision and the path it's going to have to take. He laid out kind of realistically the chances it'll have at each of these checkpoints through the judicial system, because it's already been legally challenged. I thought it was a very real speech, and he broke it down to bare bones to try to deliver this campaign promise to his base.
Jason Henry, your thoughts?
I thought it was a Trump speech. No teleprompter, which is always good and bad. Trump. Two things that I took away. Number one, he said that President Obama told him that he was preparing to go to war with North Korea, which was completely out of left field. The second part, to Frank's point, him laying out the process that somebody's going to sue, they're going to end up going to court. But what he said at the end struck me the most is that then it'll end up at the Supreme Court, which in my mind, to him and his base at least, leads them to believe that they're going to win, that he knows that this is going to be a long, drawn out process and they're prepared for it. But if it ends up at the Supreme Court, then they have a really good chance of this national emergency moving forward. Outside of that, I still don't like the way he treats the press. There was one gentleman that stood up and asked a question, and then he wanted a follow-up, and President Trump told him to sit down.
Yeah, that better be Brian Karam.
I just know that decorum isn't something that we should expect with Trump. But, you know, speaking to reporters as if they're children still kind of bothers me, that, you know, you want respect, so you have to give it as well. And I understand that the president is going to get criticism, no matter if you're President Barack Obama or President Donald Trump. And you could see that at times during his presidency, Obama had some contempt for the press, but he did not allow it to come out the way that Trump does. But going back to the overall speech, I thought it was meandering. I thought it was kind of a train wreck, but we got some good bits out of it.
Mm-hmm. Let's drill down, if we could, to what it might mean for folks here in Florida. Already there's been some comment from lawmakers from Central Florida, Daniel Webster, putting statement out, also Val Demings, representatives here in Central Florida. Any surprises there for you, Frank Torres?
Well, as far as underground here in Central Florida, you've always got to watch the money. There's money that has to be shifted around, reallocated to accommodate these changes. And of course, you know, when you're looking at the money, you're going to want to see what cutbacks, if any, are made here in Central Florida. So I think on the ground, when it comes to our listeners, you know, you're going to want to see what's getting cut, what's being moved around, what changes are being made to accommodate this declared emergency. And as far as the climate in Washington, you always want to have your party at your back, at your side. And you've seen, you know, some lawmakers on the Republican side support the president. And with our own Senate delegation, you've seen it right there. You've got Rick Scott, who supports the idea. You've got Marco Rubio, who's thinks it's a bad idea. And that's not really – it's not always the best measure on a decision that you want to hear when you make an important announcement like that.
What do you make of Marco Rubio going out on a limb and saying this is probably not the best decision?
Well, Marco Rubio, as you remember, was part of the Gang of Eight couple of years back that tried to craft that legislation. And I don't know if you remember the compromise or the offer that – the president made to the House Democrats a couple weeks ago, the negotiation on allocating funding for judicial teams, which actually attacks the problem, getting as many people in front of a judge as possible to to work on this backlog of cases. Mm-hmm.
So it's not really a war per se. It's more like border security.
It's border security and logistical support to solve the actual problem. I think that's more of the path that Marco Rubio would have preferred the president to take. I think a lot of other moderate Republicans would have preferred that as well. But this is a campaign promise. And the one reminder that when you hear wall and emergency is that Donald Trump's base is very much in favor of this. And from his base, the people that have been with him since, you know, his campaign really got off the ground, they were firmly in support of his decision.
Jason Henry, thinking about the reactions from our two senators to the declaration of a national emergency there, last year, of course, we had a Democrat and a Republican in the Senate from mm-hmm. Florida, and you would expect to hear the voice of opposition or the voice from the middle being maybe Bill Nelson's voice. Is Marco Rubio taking on some of that role now, do you think?
I don't think so. I think for Rubio, this is kind of an easy layup for him. You're probably not going to see a vote come out of this unless the House legislation that they're trying to drum up actually moves out of it. But I think that for Rubio, he's able to kind of grandstand on this a little bit to show that, no, this isn't the way that we need to take to tackle our immigration problem. The issues that we have and some of the solutions, so to speak, that I've presented is the way that I think that we need to go. And for a national emergency to be declared, I believe that Rubio's kind of taking the same track that he did with China and ZTE, where it's sort of easy. You know, Senator Rubio has been the type of politician that doesn't necessarily tackle really intricate, tough problems to solve. He usually looks for something that he can be an outlier on to make it seem as if he's attacking the problem. But I just think with this one, it's just really easy for him to come in and say, no, this is not good for America. It reminds me of the speech he gave on the Senate floor last year where he talked about there needed to be more decorum between senators. And this allows him that opportunity to kind of travel that path again. Rick Scott he's Trump all the way, man. He's 100%. He was on him. He was with him on the campaign trail. He's not going to leave him now. I know that Governor DeSantis isn't a congressman anymore, but he's going to be with him 100% as well. So I don't think Trump necessarily needs Rubio, and Rubio knows that. Mm-hmm. He has enough support in the state of Florida from two high-profile Republican politicians where Rubio can kind of, you know, track his own path, and it's not going to hurt the president.
And Frank Torres, as you said, Rubio part of that Gang of Eight that tried to get through some immigration reform and wasn't successful. But he's kind of his sort of field of expertise as a senator has been on foreign policy, right? And you see that, you know, now he's actually on the border of Venezuela, kind of looking at what's going on with aid there or the attempt from the United States to get aid to Venezuela. So do you kind of see where Jason's going with that? I'm wondering your thoughts on that, whether this is a grandstanding opportunity or whether there's something a little more subtle going on with Senator Rubio and his stance.
No, I mean, Marco Rubio's been out front on foreign policy. You see it right now. He made that trip to Colombia. He's been outspoken about supporting Venezuela and the struggles they're facing down there. And he's also been very loud on keeping Russia and China honest. And he seems to have taken foreign policy and made it his own. And when you speak or when you listen to him talk about the issue of foreign policy and what's going on around the world and compare that to what you're hearing from the president, it kind of makes the president look a little pedestrian. But, you know, let's not make any mistakes here. It's not like Marco Rubio and Donald Trump were ever good friends to begin with. You'll remember the little Marco push during the campaign trail during the campaign. So, yeah, Rubio's really gone out of his way to make foreign policy sort of his area of expertise. And I think you're going to continue to see that in the years to come.
Jason Henry, do you think some Democrats may have a little bit of buyer's remorse over the border security bill that was sent to the president and signed, if he then turned around and said, well, I'll sign it, but I'm also going to declare this national emergency?
I don't think so. I don't think so, because if you look at the funding for that bill, Even if we go back to when President Obama was in the White House, a wall, so to speak, wasn't necessarily something Democrats were really strongly opposed to.
They call it, even now, in fact.
Yeah, they call it smart fencing or a smart wall where you use drones and cameras to so-called monitor the activity that's going on the border. And the president is using more stringent language. He's saying wall. He's using some dog whistles to talk about some of the things that are happening there. But no, I mean, I think that this is a really good opportunity because this is going to stretch out maybe even till the 2020 election. And this is going to be really, really good red meat for both bases. So whether it's Val Demings, who's probably not going to have any competition coming up in 2020, she can be the loudest voice on this. Representative Stephanie Murphy, Congressman Darren Soto, they can make a lot of noise on this because they're not going to have a lot of competition coming up. And then on the other side of this, it's, you know, if I'm a Republican, at least I talk about what you guys said that this was OK. A lot of the funding in this bill, Speaker Pelosi was OK with, Senator Schumer was OK with. And these are a lot of the things that President Trump wanted. You just didn't give him all the money he wanted for a wall. But some of the border security measures, Democrats supported. So there's not really a lot of daylight between both parties on this.
Does it seem to you that Democrats are OK with giving the president some of what he wants as long as he doesn't make too much of a fuss about it? Like, is it partly about just not giving him the political win, but giving him the money to do some of what he wants to do?
I think so. Absolutely. I think this goes back to the government shutdown when Pelosi was kind of grandstanding saying that she beat Trump. And in my eyes, you wouldn't have had the government to reopen if not for the air traffic controllers and the flight attendants union. So, yeah, it was a loss for Trump, but it wasn't necessarily a win for Speaker Pelosi either and the Democrats. And then, you know, to your point, I just don't think they want a magnifying glass put up to this funding measure, because, again, a lot of the things that Democrats are saying that they are against, they were perfectly fine with saying, OK, we'll give you this, but just not too much, because that's not going to be good for us when it comes to election time.
Is it all about optics, Frank?
It's all about, you nailed it. It's all about the political win. That's really what it is all about when it comes to that level in Washington. Here we have somebody who is approaching 70, if not 70, and someone well into their 70s talking about who won their particular argument. And this comes down to Donald
Trump. Wait, you're saying it sounds a little bit like a schoolyard fight?
Sounds a little bit like a schoolyard fight. Donald Trump, Nancy Pelosi. If you look at their approval numbers, those are the two that, you know, continue to take serious hits from this. And it's all about one side wanting to deprive the other side of taking a victory and being able to declare a victory in the media. That's what it comes down to. I mean, it is terribly sad.
Is there some substance to it, though? I mean, if it means turning up the base and that's going to have an influence on the 2020 election.
There's some substance to it, but it doesn't come before the optics. I wish there was another way around, but perception is reality. And both of these sides or both of these leaders have been trying so hard just to outdo each other.
Yeah.
Whether it's arguing in the Oval Office or dueling press conferences, they just, you know, can't get enough of trying to tout their victories in this battle that's been going on for months now and will continue to go on into the 2020 election season.
Jason Henry, you're pretty active on Twitter. What are you seeing on Twitter in response to this and kind of looking ahead?
Both sides of it. One side I'm seeing is that you have a lot of Democrats and those who identify with Democrats saying that this is a bad thing, that this is something that the president shouldn't have done. You're going to see a lot of Democrats use his own words against him, saying that he said in his press conference, "I did not need to do this. Congress was moving too slow, so I figured I'd go ahead and do it." That's something that you're probably going to see in a lot of sound bites, especially when election time comes around. That's just something you're going to hear a lot about. And then the other side that I'm hearing is that this was needed, that there's just way too many drugs coming across the border, whether it be through point of entry or through illegal means, and that the president had to do what he had to do to secure the border. And then kind of down the middle, you know, you're seeing a lot of people saying that he's using a lot of racist dog whistles when he talks about the need for security at the border, and that you don't hear that type of language being used when it comes to Canada. Obviously, we're talking about two totally separate situations, but it doesn't matter when you have a president who's being accused of being a racist and using racist language. You had Senator Graham that was on TV saying that, you know what, kids in Kentucky don't necessarily need a new school because we have to make sure that we have to get the border secured, because some of the funding that's going to be used for the national emergency, for the wall, will come out of some construction funds. So I mean,
mostly military construction, right?
Mostly military construction, but I saw a report yesterday that the military has like $21 billion in reserves for construction funding. So maybe they can use some of that money to purchase or build a school in Kentucky. But I think to Frank's point, it's just really optics. That's all this is. It's always, it always goes back to politics that these situations really get blown out of proportion, because for a lot of the large scale issues that we see that Americans talk about and that politicians bring to the forefront, both parties, there's just really not a lot of daylight. We're talking about a few billion dollars, which, yeah, is a lot to us, but for the federal government, it's really not a lot. And the president and Republicans still got a lot of what they wanted in that funding measure.
Frank Torres, speaking about who stands to lose from this, we've heard a lot about the more than $3 billion that may be taken away from military construction budget to pay for this. What is the political fallout from that potentially?
I believe that it's too early to tell who's really going to lose this. As far as we go down to if we use the 2020 elections as the measuring sticks for who won from this situation, it's really too early to tell. Right now, President Trump is still trying to sort of preserve his base. It's going to be hard for him to draw in the moderates. But as you look at the other side, we're going to have to see what this large field of Democratic presidential contenders
and getting larger by the day.
They're going to do it. Yeah, it's getting larger by the day. I mean, we're going to have the JV and main debates on primetime television here in like 4 months. Yeah.
And we thought the 2016 primary was crowded on the Republican field.
Goodness sake. And they're all senators. So, I mean, they're all going to be going to work
together.
They're
not going to have anybody left. Yeah.
Exactly. So it's going to be, we're going to have to just wait and see to see how this breaks out in the courts. I think that's going to be another chapter entirely. And any other sort of changes that may come along the way before we finally realize how this played out.
Jason Henry, you talked about the flight attendants union and air traffic controllers union as being the crux of breaking the last shutdown and potentially avoiding this next shutdown that people were worried about.
Sure.
Where do you think we are now as far as where shutdowns factor into how politicians make decisions, whether it's a bargaining chip? Mm-hmm. Is it something we're not going to see for a while, do you think?
I think it is something we're going to see more of, but I think if we extrapolate that out a little bit, if you saw in Denver, you had a bunch of teachers to go on strike. If you saw in Los Angeles, you had a bunch of teachers to go on strike. And while the wall and the national emergency is kind of sucking up all the air in the room right now, I think the biggest issue in 2020 is going to be the economy. And you're going to see maybe a lot more unions try to exert their power. And in response to that, I mean, if you look at the bill that Representative Plekin passed, I believe in 2018, it could have been 2016, where he basically took the power out of unions, out of teaching unions in the state of Florida. And I think you're going to see more legislation across the country if we see more unions come out and do some of the things that they've done. Kind of reminds me of what President Reagan did back in the 80s when the air traffic controllers went on strike. He just fired all of them. And while air traffic controllers are not allowed to go on strike, the flight attendant said, OK, if this doesn't reopen, we're just going to stop. And then all of a sudden you saw some movement. So I believe this year and next year, the economy is really going to drive a lot of the conversation, just because I think you're going to see a lot more unions and a lot more folks who are just regular people like you and me that are going to exhort their economic power to try to push politicians to do some of the things that need to be done so that they can make a living wage. And I think that that's where you're going to start to see the winners and losers. It's almost setting up like it was in 2007 and 2008, where McCain and Obama were neck and neck, and then the economy collapsed. And then Barack Obama, he started to take the lead after that because he had a better command of the issues. And I think whoever the candidate is out of this, you know, field of 40 on the Democratic side, whoever has the better command of talking to regular folks like Donald Trump did back in 2016, I think that's who you'll see to emerge from this field to have the best chance of beating him in 2020.
Frank Torres, are we back to the early 90s here as far as what the issue is? Like James Carville said, it's the economy, stupid. Is that where we're at now, looking ahead to 2020?
You know, I think what's happening is the extreme sides of both parties are actually getting bigger. That's what we're seeing. And then either that or they're getting louder. And the moderates just still seem to be being catered to as often as we've seen in the past. Now, that could change as we move closer towards, you know, the election. But all the voices in the room are just so loud, and it seems like everybody's shouting right now. So it's going to take a person who can connect with the people at the grassroots level, like we saw with President Obama in 2008 and like what we saw with Donald Trump in 2016, to really find success. The economy is trucking along nicely, and everybody seems to be, you know, doing well right now. We're going to have to see how that goes as we get closer to the election. And there's going to be other things that will become issues in this campaign, and including immigration and this border wall. So we're just going to have to see how everything works out before we really get a grasp of the pulse of how everybody's feeling and everybody's doing.
Frank Torres is a Republican political analyst. Thank you so much, Frank.
Anytime.
And we're also joined by Jason Henry, Democratic political analyst. Jason, thank you as well.
Always.
Still to come on Intersection, lessons learned from NASA's long-lived Martian rover Opportunity. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. After 15 years, NASA has declared Opportunity's mission complete. Last week, the agency tried to contact the Mars rover one last time. The rover had been radio silent since June. Designed to only spend 90 days exploring, the mission far exceeded expectations, clocking in at a decade and a half while traversing 28 miles across the Red Planet. The mission captivated more than just the science community. The photos being back from the Red Planet gave everyone here on Earth incredible views of another world. Opportunity's death was grieved by many online in the form of comic strips, obituaries, and remembrances from the people that spent their careers working on the mission. For a look at Opportunity's legacy, 90.7 space reporter Brendan Byrne spoke with Dan Batchelder. He's the head of aerospace physics and space sciences at Florida Tech.
Dan Batchelder, thanks for joining us.
No problem. Always a pleasure.
Do you remember where you were when Opportunity landed?
Well, that's a rather telling question, isn't it? I mean, I was just finishing off or attempting to finish off the second year of my PhD back in 2000 and... when was it? 2003? Yeah, 2003. And so, yeah, I was just about to move from the United Kingdom over to the United States. And my research at that time was very heavily focused on the centers of galaxies using the Hubble Space Telescope. So it's only been in the last 5 years or so I've actually been doing research that's been needing to take the data from the Opportunity rover and the other rovers and actually integrate it into the research that we're doing here.
That's interesting you say that, because Opportunity was only supposed to spend a few days operating on the surface of Mars, and you're saying that you've been using data in the past 5 years from Opportunity.
Yes, that's right. I mean, this is one of the awesome achievements of the technology that we've been able to put onto the surfaces of other worlds. And one wonders whether or not the engineers purposely underestimate how long their equipment is going to last on there, so that we can all come around and praise them for the for reaching their requirements and exceeding them. So, originally designed for a few months, but has actually gone on for over a decade, nearly 15 years. An absolutely incredible achievement. And, just the awe-dropping panoramas that have the jaw-dropping panoramas that have come from the images that we've received back from Opportunity and Spirit and Curiosity, they just do part of what we call the wonder and the wonder. We're a species that wonders about our place in the universe, and also wonders about our place in the universe, right? Both in terms of our curiosity and our thirst for knowledge and our desire to actually explore. And so I think the mission, the Opportunity mission, has just shown us what we can achieve and show us how much future opportunity there is for exploring the surfaces of planets like Mars with future robotic missions, and indeed, hopefully, within, you know, the cliche of the next 20 years, humans.
Dan Batchelder, I'm wondering if you can kind of give us a sense of just how harsh of an environment Opportunity is or was working in. What are the conditions like on Mars, and how did it kind of batter this robot for a decade and a half?
Well, the conditions on Mars that the Opportunity rover has had to endure are somewhat different than the conditions that we have here on Earth. So one of the biggest differences, of course, is that Mars is 1.5 times farther away from the sun than the Earth. And so it receives a lot less solar radiation. It is also a planet that has had its atmosphere eroded away by the solar wind. And so right now, the surface conditions are very low pressure, relatively cold, and an atmosphere that's comprised primarily of carbon dioxide. And so if you were standing on the surface of Mars, you would need a spacesuit because of the atmospheric conditions. But a robot like Opportunity, of course, not having complex biological systems but complex mechanical systems, still has to take into account the fact that it's driving around in temperatures that are minus 100 Celsius, even colder in some cases, a very low pressure, and a very dusty environment as well. So if, for example, you consider how joints, mechanical joints here on Earth work, if you have metal on metal, you would use some kind of grease in between those joints. Well, for the engineering that has to take place to get a mission like Opportunity functioning, you have to know that grease behaves very differently in low temperatures and low pressures. And if there's dust going to be getting into the joints of your mechanical arm, that is going to create a huge problem. And so, yes, the environment, the atmospheric environment on Mars is a challenge. But it's obviously something that Opportunity has met and exceeded. And so this is providing us with a lot of very exciting data that will go on and inform future missions, particularly as they get more and more complex, working towards hopefully what you and I, Brendan, hope to be a colony on the surface of Mars sometime within the next 20 years.
I'll see you there, Dan. I'm reminded of a time when that environment actually helped Opportunity, right? There was a storm that actually helped blow off some dust off of her solar panels. Can you talk about that a bit?
Sure, yeah. So out with mechanical devices, they obviously require power. And there are several ways to achieve that. You can use an onboard power source, or you can use the naturally occurring resources like the sun. And so in the case of Opportunity and Spirit, they both used solar panels in order to recharge their batteries so that they could carry on their missions. But, of course, because of the dusty environment, that dust is actually layering itself onto the surface of the rovers, including the solar panels. And so, of course, as you get a more dusty solar panel, the amount of light that actually falls onto the photovoltaic cells that are producing the energy to recharge the batteries actually drops. And so this is like a dirty window. It becomes harder and harder to see out of a dirty window. And the windows on top of the solar panels were getting layers and layers and layers of dust on them. So two things that happen with the rovers, very interesting. The first one is that because Mars does have a very thin atmosphere, there are some weather events that occur. In particular, there are dust devils, and there's some fantastic images of dust devils moving around the Martian surface. And so you can actually, and this did actually happen, the wind events that occurred on Mars were actually able to blow off some of the dust that had settled on the solar panels, and thus allowing more power from the sun to fall onto those photovoltaic cells and recharge the batteries. And so that extended the mission lifetime, particularly of Opportunity. And then, of course, another way of doing it is to drive up a bank so that the dust actually falls off the surfaces of the rover as well. So, yeah, you can both use the natural terrain and also the weather on Mars to help clean off your solar panels.
Now, after spending a decade and a half on the surface of Mars, I mean, the scientific data that's coming that came from Opportunity, we probably don't have enough time to talk about all of that. But can you give me some highlights of some of the big discoveries that we can credit to the exploration of Opportunity?
Well, yeah, one of the most interesting discoveries from Opportunity happened relatively early in the mission, and that was it came across a meteorite sitting on the surface of Mars. And what's really interesting about the meteorites that we find on the surface of Mars is because they haven't had to go through as thick of an atmosphere that we have here on Earth, the meteorite that was found on the surface of Mars by Opportunity was actually the size of a soccer ball. So that's quite an impressive meteorite. Now, meteorites in themselves are really interesting because they are leftover remnants from the formation of our solar system. And so finding one of these things on the surface of Mars reiterated that Mars and Earth themselves, in the grand scheme of things, are relatively similar planets. They both formed around about the same distance from the Sun. Mars being just 1.5 times farther away from the Earth isn't such a big deal in the grand scale of the solar system, where Jupiter is 5 times as far and Saturn is 10 times as far. Mars and Earth formed around about the same distance from the Sun, around about the same time, from around about the same stuff. And so being able to find a meteorite on the surface of Mars, like finding meteorites on the surface of Earth, was just a great reminder of the fact that we're so closely tied to Mars in terms of the history of the solar system. It was a very exciting reminder of that, along with all of the amazing science that can come from that.
And what about the search for life on Mars or signs of life on Mars? What role has Opportunity played in that?
So, in terms of searching for signs of life, the overarching philosophy on that has been to follow the water. And that is a term that has been used to guide surface missions on Mars for decades. And so the idea is that life has to have liquid water in order for it to propagate. And so the position on the planet where Opportunity was chosen to land was one of the positions where it was thought that there was water activity in the past. And so it was purposefully landed in a particularly interesting spot in terms of being able to search for past signs of water activity. And so there are several key discoveries that Opportunity made, which demonstrated that, yes, in the past, there were areas of Mars where it was wet. And that is some data that's been consistent with the other landers that have been going on in the past decades. And I'm sure that the future landers are going to take that information and it's going to inform the science that's going to take place on future missions. And indeed, maybe even support what we call in situ resource utilization, which will be using the naturally occurring resources on Mars in order to help support future missions, including missions that will have crew.
How is this kind of laying the groundwork for answering some of the questions you have and some of the future research that you're doing, both yourself and with your students there at Florida Tech?
So in terms of how Opportunity is informing the research that we're doing here at Florida Tech, it has played a central role. Essentially, what we joke that these rovers are basically big chemistry sets on wheels that are driving around on the surface of a planet telling us about what stuff they've been finding in terms of the chemistry. And so we've been taking the data that has come back from Opportunity, combining it with the data from Spirit and Curiosity as well. And we've been using that in order to reproduce as best we can materials that we find here on Earth so that they are a good simulant for the surface materials on Mars. And then once we have that simulant, and we think we've got pretty good simulants now, once we have that simulant, we're now using that in order to perform more chemistry to see whether we can actually reclaim or get out of that simulant usable materials like water and oxygen and metals to help support a colony. Going to be very useful to determine how this material will behave if we start to use it for helping in the construct of complex colonies, including the use of regolith as a radiation shield, including processing regolith into landing pads where we've got burns set up to stop where the dust and particles kind of being rocketed out as we've got future missions landing on the surface of Mars. And so these types of activities, you know, are really essential as we plan the next 20 years worth of science and engineering that's going to have to go into laying out the groundwork for a future mission to the surface. Yeah.
So opportunities laying the groundwork for these future missions. But after 15 years of exploring the Martian surface and providing data to scientists like you, what do you think its biggest legacy is going to be? When we look back decades from now, what will we remember about Opportunity?
Well, the first thing that's going to be remembered is that this was Opportunity was a mission designed for 90 days that lasted 15 years. I mean, that's an incredible feat of engineering. And we should take that as a great sign that we do have the capability of surviving in the harsh environments that that Mars presents us, and that we shouldn't underestimate the ability of this species to overcome the engineering challenges of actually getting people to the surface of Mars and having them operate there in a safe environment. Has been operating for so long on the surface just gives us great, great data on how sustainable and how rugged the technology that we have developed already will be able to help with a sustained presence on human presence on the surface of these bodies. I mean, it's just fantastic.
We've been speaking with Dan Batchelder. He's the head of aerospace physics and space science at Florida Tech. Dan, thanks so much for speaking with us.
No problem at all, Brendan. Thank you for your time.
This conversation first aired on our podcast, Are We There Yet? You can subscribe to that wherever you get your podcasts for more conversations about space exploration. Up next, Elena Newport was working for a senator on Capitol Hill when she and a group of friends launched the Capitol Steps. What started out as an office Christmas party skit has turned into a full-time job as a political satirist. That's ahead when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty.
Hit it, maestro! Things look swell. Mary Gays, raise the terrorist minimum wage. Starting here, starting now. Honey, everything's run by Pelosi. You got it! Raise the bar.
That's a song from the Capitol Steps, the musical comedy troupe out of Washington, D.C. The Capitol Steps will be bringing their brand of political satire to Orlando next week. Ahead of their visit, I caught up with founding member, writer and performer Elena Newport. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, glad to be on. We're headed your way.
So Capitol Steps began way back in 1981. Tell me about your involvement with the very first kind of stages of this performance troupe.
Well, it was an odd story. I was working for Senator Charles Percy from Illinois back in 1981, and he was one of those Republican moderates that you don't find in the wild anymore. They're gone. But we were just saying, okay, what are we going to do at this year's Christmas party? We got to throw together a few skits. And my co-writer had some lyrics, and I played the piano. And we just did a few songs and skits, and everybody liked it so much that, you know, they invited us to perform the next week and the week after, and it kind of kept going. I mean, we thought we'd be fired or told to stop or both, but we never were.
Were all of you initially working for lawmakers on Capitol Hill?
We were. We were kind of, we were Senate staffers, and we thought, uh-oh, this is going to jeopardize our day jobs, and someday, you know, this is going to come back to haunt us. But the surprise over the years was that a lot of the politicians that we worked for kind of liked it, and they invited us to perform for them, even if we had songs and skits about them. In fact, a lot of them wanted songs and skits about them. The only senator that ever got mad at us after a show was D'Amato from New York, and he was mad because we didn't have a song about him.
All publicity is good publicity. There's some variation of that going on there, I guess.
Yes, that's right. The worst thing you can do to a politician is ignore him or her.
What about now? Is it is this a full-time gig, or do some of you still have day jobs as well?
This is a full-time gig now. I worked on Capitol Hill for 7 years after we started this group. And in 1988, they sort of started to realize that I wasn't showing up at my day job as much as I should. I was kind of missing a lot of work. So I decided to kind of run away and join the circus, and do this full time. And now everybody in the Capitol Steps is full time and travels the country doing this.
Did you ever imagine that you would kind of make your way into theater? I mean, it sounds like you were set on a political career from the get-go.
Oh, right. I mean, our worst fear was that, you know, in, you know, 10 years after we started this troupe, that we'd be, you know, nominated for Undersecretary for Infectious Diseases or something. And they would say, but didn't you back in 1981 make fun of the president? And we'd have to go, oh, there goes my career. But instead, it turned out to be the opposite, that this was the more stable career, because I lost two jobs with senators that lost elections. So there you have it.
What have the last 2 years been like? Because there's been a real kind of tectonic shift in politics with the election of President Trump, just the way politics is kind of done and how people respond to it. I mean, the news cycle, I don't know whether it always seems like this, but it just seems like things are happening incredibly quickly, and no sooner than one story has come out, you've got another one to respond to. How do you deal with that as a performer and, you know, a writer, and somebody's trying to turn it into satire?
Oh, well, that's exactly right. There's a lot of guesswork involved because, you know, we'll think one day, okay, say Trump announces we're pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord, and we think, oh, that's a huge story. We got to write a song about pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord. And then the next day, nobody cares because we've discovered some other scandal or there's a tweet or something. So it does make our jobs as writers very difficult. And we have to adapt. We do have one song that's basically about all his tweeting. It's called Tweet It, to the Michael Jackson's Beat It. And we just insert the latest tweet and the latest scandal into that.
And how many of you are there? What size is the cast?
Well, we do the show with five performers and a pianist. And that's kind of an interesting number because, you know, that means that the woman who plays Nancy Pelosi might also be playing Angela Merkel and Melania Trump and Elizabeth Warren, in changing her wigs and her accents and running on and off stage. So it's a very fast-paced show. Somebody once said we have more costume changes than a Cher concert.
And who do you play?
I do love playing Nancy Pelosi because you freeze your forehead and you blink real fast, and then everybody thinks it's a brilliant Nancy Pelosi impression.
Is there anyone you've really struggled to kind of capture their mannerisms or had trouble trying to make them funny or even just somebody you would think, I just can't do that? Anybody you've turned down?
Well, no, I mean, well, one of the hardest things in our show is, I mean, you try finding a wig that looks as bad as Bernie Sanders' hair or Donald Trump's hair. So I think the star of our show is the person who tries to help us create the characters because, you know, you can't find these things in wig stores. You have to kind of like, you know, pull hairs out and, you know, dishevel them and all that. But, you know, we do cartoons of the characters. So, for example, you know, we would do enormous ears on Barack Obama or, you know, like, or we would have Vladimir Putin appear shirtless, you know, because you're kind of exaggerating. Or actually, that's true in real life. He does appear shirtless.
Right. But you're sort of taking things that you might see in a meme on Twitter or something and trying to turn that into some live theater.
Right. Like the Nancy Pelosi State of the Union clap. That'll get into the show right away. That kind of thing.
Have you been rehearsing that?
Yes, we have. Yeah, that only took 5 minutes to rehearse. That was pretty easy.
Who are your most popular characters? Like, who are the people that you portray that get the biggest laughs and the biggest applause rounds?
Well, you know, the party in power is always going to be the funniest characters. So, like, right now, of course, we've got a lot of things about Trump and Pence, and, you know, there are Mitch McConnell's in the show, and but on the other hand, we like to be bipartisan. So we've got, you know, Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren. We try to kind of get everybody. And even if the party in power is funnier, we try to balance the show as much as we can.
And who's your audience? Like, who do you find kind of responds best to the material? Obviously, there are people who have a vested interest in seeing themselves on stage, or it sounds like back in the early days were keen to see themselves portrayed. But do you find that there are places you go where you get, you know, the people are kind of following it more closely and maybe more sort of invested in this kind of satire?
Well, we've been on National Public Radio for many years. We've done specials, and we were on All Things Considered for many years. So we get a lot of NPR, like kind of news junkies. But one of the interesting things about that was that after the 2016 election, some of those people were kind of concerned about, okay, they were fighting with their family about politics at the Thanksgiving table. Can I really go out and laugh? And so the best comment that we would get after the election was somebody would come up to us and say, I wasn't sure I could laugh, but I did, and I feel better.
Do you feel there's a serious side to what you're doing as well, though? I mean, are there some things where you might sort of approach it in a humorous way, but you're trying to get a point across at all? Or is it just to let off steam?
Well, it's a lot of it's to let off steam. And then sometimes there's very serious issues in the news. You know, for example, if you take a really extreme example, a few years back when you had Hurricane Katrina, and that was the only thing in the news for about 2 weeks, and it wasn't funny at all. But there was politicians that were kind of messing up, and, you know, Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job, and FEMA wasn't responding correctly. So you can kind of go after some of the institutions that are handling the situation badly, and that's fair game. And I think it's a, you know, kind of a good point to make.
And you talked about how when you all got started, there were folks who you were satirizing who just wanted to see themselves on stage. And it sounded like they weren't too concerned as to whether it was a flattering portrayal or not. They just wanted to make sure that they were in the frame. What about now, though? I mean, are politicians as keen to kind of see themselves satirized? Has that mood changed at all?
Well, the mood has changed a little. I mean, the current president is not real fond of it, as from what I can tell, because he doesn't go to the gridiron dinners and things like that. But back when, you know, George Bush Sr. in particular really loved seeing portrayals of himself. He invited Dana Carvey to the White House. He invited us to the White House. And one time we went and the staff was very nervous and they said, well, don't do anything about the president or the vice president. And we were like, oh, what do we do? So we did a show about Congress and everything else. And at the end of the show, George Bush Sr. came up on stage and said, well, I think the show has been censored. What do you have about me? And that was it. We had fair game. So we went out and we did everything we had about him.
When you travel around, like the show that you're going to be performing in Orlando, are you going to be bringing some material that you might not necessarily be rolling out in a show in DC, for example? Like, are there going to be some Florida politicians you'll be pointing out, or are there some skits that are specific to Orlando or Florida politicians that you'll be trying out on the audience down here?
Well, if there's a local scandal, let us know. But generally, our show is national headlines. Although, of course, for many years we had a lot of Florida material in our show. For a while, you were the funniest state, and now maybe I live in the funniest state of Virginia. But yeah, for years after the 2000 elections, we used to go to Florida and tell them that we were there to thank them for all of the material. And I actually got to play a hanging Chad once in the show and put a piece of cardboard around my head and sang, "You Keep Me Hanging On."
So you're telling me there you're not going to be revising that, because I don't know if you were paying attention last year, but we had some election issues in Florida in 2018 as well.
Yeah, well, maybe, you know, maybe the occasional joke or two about that.
Anything else you'd like to add for our audience to listen out for, Elena Newport?
Well, I mean, to anybody who's never seen the show, I guess what I would say is if you've ever wanted to see, you know, Bernie Sanders sing a show tune and Donald Trump sing a rock song and Vladimir Putin dance shirtless, this is the show for you. You can't see it anywhere else.
Well, Elena Newport is a founding member, writer, and performer with Capital Steps. Thank you so much for joining us, Elena.
Looking forward to coming down. Thank you.
And you can find more details about the Capital Steps visit to Orlando over on our website, wmfe.org. Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Ashley Garrett. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.